Donald on the Kitchen talks about food. Donald on the Kitchen talks recipes. Donald on the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donald on the Kitchen, and Merry Christmas from both of us.
Yes, Merry Christmas to all of you. Happy holidays.
My name is Lana Noctico.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We have been bringing you good stuff for many years here at this fine community radio station, and we get by with a little help from our friends.
Oh, yes. The Donna Lana Kitchen Show is sponsored in part by the Mucky Duck Pub, where pub means community. For more information, go to themuckyduckpub.com or call the pub and ask for Marcus, and go over and bring in a glass with a bunch of your friends here.
Very good. Very good. The following is a reheated, revisited, rebroadcast conglomeration of stuff having to do with many of our old Christmas shows. We've had fine people on this radio show, and we're just kind of dove into our archives so we could stay home for Christmas.
Yeah, because we're home cooking today.
We are.
Yeah.
We are. So
in the kitchens.
Merry Christmas to all of you. We're moving into the closing of the year. Donna's been busy in the kitchen with some special holiday treats. I've got some thoughts about ginger snaps and caroling. And we are delighted to have a visit from Mary Swander, Poet Laureate from the state of Iowa. Welcome, Mary.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Good. Yes. The term Yule, Y-U-L-E, is often used for this time of year. And Yule derives from the Anglo-Saxon, which means yoke of the year, like yoke for oxen. It's a balancing point across the ebbs of sunlight. The Yule Festival is many different celebrations, and the celebration of Mother Night starts at sunset on the 20th of December. And that's when the sun turns around and starts coming back to us. And, of course, us being human beings and us being on this planet for a long time, people have been celebrating this sort of thing for a long time. For many, many traditions, it's the time when the sun, S-U-N, or sun, S-O-N, gets reborn. There's a lot of deities, including Jesus Christ, that gets born this time of year.
Lots and lots of cultures all over the world.
Yes. That's good. That's good. So you plan on having a solstice celebration?
Yes, by candlelight.
Oh, candlelight. That sounds really, really good.
Actually, I also have a nice collection of old kerosene lamps. It's for emergencies and for celebrations.
Well, let's celebrate then. Let's celebrate. That's good.
You can also build a bonfire. Mm-hmm. There was an old tradition of jumping over the bonfire. Of course, you don't want to make it too high if you're going to do that. You'll burn your coattails.
And you mentioned something about fire and raisins.
Oh, this is an old, I think it's an English tradition, and this is for the 12 days of Christmas. So on the 12th day, you take a kind of a, you're supposed to have a party on that day too, right? So, and we did this one year. It was really, really fun. You have a sort of a wide, shallow dish, and you put a bunch of raisins in it, and you pour the brandy over it. Then you light the brandy, and everyone is supposed to take, with their fingers, pick a raisin out of the burning brandy. And brandy burns at a very low temperature, so it's actually not that hot, but it's kind of, it's a little bit thrilling to stick your hand in the fire.
Sounds real showy. It's really fun. What a thing to giggle about.
Yes, children love it, but don't do it for little children.
Oh, no. It sounds fun. Mary, do you have any solstice celebrations or solstice ideas?
Well, yeah. I mean, I live in the middle of the Amish community, and they don't have any electricity, and so sort of every day is a solstice for them. Kerosene lamps and candles. But, just sitting here, I had all sorts of great old-timey memories of my childhood. My little Irish grandmother would every year make plum pudding and light it on fire.
Oh, that's right.
It was just wonderful as a kid, to see that. And my mother made very, very yummy divinity But it made her a nervous wreck because she was constantly watching the barometer, you know, to see if it was going to turn out. And sometimes it didn't. And then the Happy, our dog's name was Happy, would be very happy.
He would get the divinity?
Oh.
Rot his teeth out, probably.
Well, happy solstice to the doggy, then. That's right. Very good. That's very good. Well, Mary, you have been a wonderful part of this community for a long time, and we've always enjoyed your writing and your reading and your good sense of humor. Do you have something to share with us today?
I do. I have a little piece called the Amish Christmas Pageant, and it's a little essay about one of the things I really look forward to so much every year, which is the Christmas pageant in the one-room school in Amish land. Squeezed together on the hard wooden benches in the meeting room of the country schoolhouse, we sang Christmas carols, a slow, modal sound echoing off the plain pine walls. It came upon a midnight clear. Outside, the storm cocooned us in snow, the flakes swirling through the darkness, covering the horses at the hitching post. It was the night of the Christmas program in my neighborhood, a rural Iowa community where I am one of the few English or non-Amish. Several families were delayed, their sleighs inching over waist-high drifts. Malin, the minister, kept us singing, his hand moving up and down with a steady rhythm. That glorious time of old. Then some older boys extinguished the kerosene lanterns hanging from the ceiling hooks. Our voices hushed. A chorus of young voices arose from the basement steps, the notes pure and clear. 13 Amish children and their teacher, who couldn't have been more than 18 years old, wound through the meeting room. Each child carried a single white candle, the light glowing in their hands. With angels bending toward the earth, the candles were snuffed, the lanterns relit, and the children went into a sing-song rhyming recitation of a poem dedicated to Grandma. Just one grandma, I thought? There have to be others here. The room was packed with older women, their shawls draped over their shoulders, their white hair pulled back into buns. But when the poem was finished, just one grandma stood up and bowed. I realized that she was the ancestor of all the children, these siblings and cousins smiling out at us with the same grin that swept across the old woman's face. We kept our gifts small this year and gave money to a needy children's fund, Malin announced, handing out small packages wrapped in old grocery bags and tied with bright ribbons. The boys received a pair of pliers or a pocket knife, the girls a comb or handkerchief. The older children lined up against the wall, the younger ones disappearing into the coat room. God loves all the children of the world, their voices sang. One by one, verse by verse, the younger children reappeared. 7-year-old Perry's head bobbed under a huge sombrero, his blonde bangs falling down in his face. 8-year-old Samuel wore a thick hooded fur parka and clomped across the floor in snowshoes. 9-year-old Marvin wore a Native American headdress. Even though I agreed with the sentiment of the skit, I squirmed in my seat a bit, uncomfortable with these old stereotypes. Then 10-year-old Hannah jogged in running shoes and a down jacket. God even loves the English, the teacher laughed. That's good, I thought, knowing that in the end, no matter what the clothing or nationality, we all descend from a common ancestor. I grinned across the room at Grandma.
Thank you, Mary. What a wonderful story. You have a really wonderful opportunity to enjoy a community that is seldom we think of that sort of community anymore. There used to be small towns and closer-knit farm families that we were connected to in past generations, but that is still going on.
Oh, that's right. It's a real neighborhood. That's what I tell people. People come, you know, to visit me and like from Chicago or something, they always say, oh, don't you get bored out here? Isn't, you know, what do you have to do out here? And I'm like, oh, my gosh, there's something going on all the time that's so incredibly interesting. And they say, well, do you know any of these weird people, these neighbors you live in? I'm like, yeah, I know a few of them. And I'm really so privileged to be included in moments like that. I think, you know, this really – well, first of all, it's as you see from the piece, it's one or two big huge extended families, but then neighbors have a special niche, and you know we get together and celebrate birthdays and holidays, and we have a neighborhood picnic every summer that's just to die for, and you can really have a great if you want a great game of volleyball come to that picnic.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
Well, by way of explanation, we didn't say this, but Mary lives in Ames, but she also has an old Amish farmhouse over near Kelowna where she lives.
Old Amish schoolhouse.
Yeah, it's a schoolhouse.
Yeah.
That's a house.
Yeah. It's an old schoolhouse. Yeah. It's sort of that's also interesting because it's like, you know, I live in a historical place that schoolhouse is the only public building for Amish, and so they all have an attachment there.
So, but it was your schoolhouse that you live in now, the schoolhouse that they use?
Yes.
Okay.
Used to go to. And actually, it's coming up this summer. Every 5 years, we have a Fairview School reunion.
Oh.
And so, like, everybody that's still alive that went to that schoolhouse comes back. And it's, you know, they sing their little songs. They bring old report cards and pictures. They tell stories.
Didn't you say that all the women come in and clean from top to
bottom? That's the best part. That's why I insist we keep this tradition going, because the day before, like a squadron of like 7 to 10 women will come in, and you know it's like having spring house cleaning for me. They take down all the curtains. They you know wash the floor, everything. And then the men come with their like weed whackers, and they you know they'll mow the lawn. Oh, it's just great. Trim the bushes, paint the fence posts. It's fantastic. So
lovely.
Highly recommend it.
How large a community is this? How many families do you think live all around you in this group?
It's big. There are 5,000 Amish and different Mennonite sects in that community. So it's. You know, it's significant. It's the largest Amish community west of the Mississippi River.
And you've done a great job of telling their story. Generally people who choose to live that sort of lifestyle do not care to have their faces and their stories told.
No.
But somehow you tell them with respect and generosity, and they're your friends.
No, they are. Yes. They are. They crack jokes all the time. They're like, watch out. Don't let her next to you sitting at the table. She's got a little tape recorder in her pocket. She takes down every single thing we say. I don't have a recorder. And they go, you can't possibly remember all that. And I said, yes, I actually do.
Yep. You're very good.
Actually, the name of the book that Mary was reading from is called Out of This World, A Woman's Life Among the Amish. And I love that book. I just... get a copy or get it from the library or something. It's
right.
It really
you can get you can. They still have some in bookstores and online. And Ames Public Library has
one
a copy.
Mary's mini books, as a matter of fact. Yeah. But this one is very Iowan.
Mm-hmm. When was this book written?
This is a while ago. This was came out in 1996, I think. Mm-hmm. And but you know what's impressed me about solstice, Christmas, and that area is that it's very reverential, but it's very, you know, there's no commercialism to it. And so, it's sort of like the old true meaning of Christmas. It's to encourage people to give to each other, to charities. It's, you know, It's hard to get together when you're in a buggy, in a horse, you know, travel long distances.
And they really do just travel in horses,
right.
Horses and buggies.
Right.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. And so, and then they're different communities. So the next community is about 20 miles away. That's a long trip in a buggy, and they do make that trip. But so they often combine Thanksgiving and Christmas with their families. You know, they're just like, you English, why'd you put those two holidays right together so we have to get back in the buggy and do this all over again? And so they're like, okay, we'll just fold them together.
So they blame you for everything, Mary. I think this is good.
They still can't quite figure out our culture. I think it's just funny because you can see, you know, you get to see your culture through mm-hmm. somebody else's eyes, and they're always scratching their heads.
I'd like to see a sleigh.
That's my favorite part of winter.
It's mythic, but I have never actually seen one.
Oh, they're really cool. I've gotten to ride in them and everything. It's just so cool.
Oh, for goodness sakes, how wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, sleighs make total sense. You go right over the, you know, top of the snow to grandmother's house. And
Are bells added to the horses? Yeah,
there are bells, jingle bells.
Oh, are bells. I just knew there might be.
Yeah.
Are the bells decorative? The Amish aren't decorative, are they?
They'll put them on the sleigh or, you know. No, they're not real decorative. There's no Christmas trees. There are no wreaths. There's none of that. And, of course, there's no blinking lights.
But, of course, you could polish the bells.
You can.
Well, are the bells a safety feature or something?
It probably started out that way. Yeah, like, here we come.
You can't hear a sled the way you can hear a wagon.
Yeah. And, you know, now they have to have, like, the triangle slow-moving vehicle.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
That's all you have.
No lanterns?
Well, yeah. Well, now, in the old sleighs, they didn't have that. But now on the buggies, they have like a battery-powered flashing light, a lot of them for safety reasons. But, boy, I'll tell you, driving out there at night, I take it really slow because you never know what you're going to come up upon on the next hill.
On the roads, yeah.
Yeah.
They're moving at a different speed.
Oh, lovely. So are you headed back to that area for Christmas?
I am.
How nice.
That'd be great. Yeah. There's I always love to get in on caroling over there as the young people go around. Oh, it's so great in horse-drawn wagons and carol, you know, for different people. You open your door and there are 15 young Amish kids on your doorstep singing in three-part harmony.
Oh, goodness. And they're used to singing together. I mean.
Oh, yeah. You know, and again, they're usually related, so they have that kind of Everly Brothers, you know, same vocal cord.
That makes sense, the Amish Everly Brothers. That's good. I had a wonderful experience this past weekend. Some of us here in Ames got together at a friend's house for a potluck and a caroling party. But unlike this community that you talk about, we all in our past probably have Christmas music, but so few of us even sing at all anymore. Mm-hmm. So we all look at one another and can all remember the first line to everything, and we belt it into it, and then it kind of drizzles off. Because not only don't we know the words anymore.
You don't know the verses.
We don't know the verses, and how does that start? And we're a little afraid of singing. So so this year, this was the second annual. So this year I printed up a bunch of music, which helped a whole lot. Yeah.
Oh, so you had the words.
There's nothing worse.
Jogs the memory. Yeah.
But it was really a fun thing to do. And it was a fine chance to sing and surprise and delight the neighbors. Because not only do we just sing in this one living room, but we had the great idea to, let's go visit so-and-so and visit so-and-so. They had no idea we were coming. And so there was this knock on the door about 6:30. And people would come kind of bleary-eyed. And they would smile because they'd recognize some of us. And we sang for people. And surprised the dickens out of them, and it was really fun. And then, of course, we went back and ate. So it was a fine thing to do. Caroling is a really fun thing to do.
And the weather was quite reasonable.
The weather was great. Last year, it was very cold, but we toughed it out, and we lost our voices. This year, it was a very English Charles Dickens sort of thing. It was very wet and foggy, and we were so good. Okay, yes, in the bleak midwinter kind of caroling we did.
It was so wet that on Sunday, what I was doing was making divinity. I have to say, it was the worst experience of my – it tastes good, but the texture is just – you know, they call it divinity fudge, of course. And I had been to visit my only remaining aunt, who's 95, and we were talking about Christmas candies and black walnuts and, oh, divinity. So I said, all right, I will make divinity this year, having never done it before. So I'm mailing some to her. So I'm getting the divinity ready. And with that humidity – I just could not get it to firm up. It was gooey. It was sticky. I stuck it in the oven. Now it came out crunchy like meringues, and you can sink your teeth into it. It was terrible. It tastes good, but the texture, it's all wrong.
Oh, divinity.
Gooey, gooey, gooey.
Oh, let's take a little break and think about winter here with the snowflake reel. We're back. You're listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen on KHOI Radio, KHOI Community Radio, the heart of Iowa. Thanks for listening to this program. We appreciate your ears. We're back here with Mary Swander, who's sharing some of her...
The Iowa Poet Laureate.
Yes, Iowa Poet Laureate. And we are here sharing some of her Christmas... She's sharing some of her Christmas and solstice and winter memories and her wonderful reading. She's going to share another story with us. Take it away, Mary.
By the power invested in me as your emperor, I do decree that everyone in the Roman world must find his way back to his hometown to register. Caesar Augustus stood in the middle of Fairview School. 50 shepherds, sheep, kings, and angels gathered around him. He read from a long scroll, enunciating perfectly and booming the words out with clear authority. A census will be taken of my entire kingdom. A few days before Christmas, I assembled friends from all over the area, and we reenacted the nativity scene, the living creche, a traditional place for Christmas pageants. Fairview School, where I live now, provided the perfect setting, with the ground frozen but not yet impassable, the Iowa flag flying from the pole in a steady breeze but not yet a howling wind, and a few snowflakes just beginning to fall but not yet turning into a blizzard. There was no script and parts were not assigned, although cross-gender roles were encouraged. At first we had a good old-fashioned Midwestern potluck dinner. Beginning in the late afternoon, just before the sunset, the guests arrived, touting casserole dishes and breadboards, halos and staffs. "Peace be with you," a local realtor was the first to appear, with barbecued chicken wings under his arm and a scraggly beard pasted to his face. He stood before me in a long, flowing robe studded with rhinestones, a pair of pointed slippers on his feet, and a crown on his head. "I come bearing gifts," he said, and turned my oven on low to keep the chicken warm. Next, Donna the neighbor showed up at the door, dressed as another king, and a friend's 12-year-old daughter as a third. Yet a fourth, a Jewish journalist, came with his press tag dangling from his shirt, Mr. Weissman the Third. An artist, originally from Alabama, stuffed a pillow under her dress and became the pregnant St. Elizabeth, cousin of Mary. "Who are we?" she said, standing next to her husband. "Baptists. Southern Baptists." So then we all assembled, and we had a little procession out into the yard going to the barn, and I got to play the Virgin Mary, so I got to ride the donkey, Katie, to the barn. And but, you know, we were looking for room at the end, so we stopped at the neighbor's mudroom door. St. Joseph knocked at the mudroom door, and our neighbor Stu appeared. "See if they'll take MasterCard, will you, honey?" I called. "Can we stay for the night? My wife's about to have a baby." "Do you have a reservation?" We didn't think to call ahead. "I'm sorry." "Oh," I moaned from the donkey. "My wife's going into labor. There's the barn." In the barn, all my past Christmases flashed before me, from those of great joy and festivity of my youth to those rather barren ones of the past few years. Trees and stockings, wrapping paper and bows, even the great beauty of the choirs during midnight mass, all fell away at this moment. Another beauty took over, one of simplicity and starkness, of living your life on the animal level, of going through the miracle of birth on the basis plane, finding your God, finding your place, your connection to all life in a wooden shelter with the smell of droppings around you. In that instant, the Christmas story became wilder, more feral, more full of energy and raw power, closer to the primitive spirit world, closer to me. Silent night, holy night, all is calm. All is bright. Thank you for coming to my home and sharing this celebration with me. I said to my friends after we'd finished the last carol and were about to wind back along the path to the school, the stars in the sky shining brightly down upon us. Inside, I had a box of oranges that my Amish neighbor Moses had sent me from Florida. I planned to give one to every guest. Have a wonderful Christmas and New Year. I couldn't find the words to say more.
Thank you, Mary.
Welcome.
So nice to be able to have, to be able to reenact and to relive and retell the story with your neighbors and your animals, too.
Well, I'm not sure everyone has a donkey.
We had the donkey, the goat, the sheep. We had the dogs and the cats in there. It was really
fun. And the wise men.
We had lots of wise men. We had tons of wisdom that day.
I don't know. Seems to be a shortage of wisdom around. Oh, boy. Yes. Let me tell you my herring recipe.
Oh. Now, are we talking herrings or red herrings here?
Oh, no. This is not a red herring, although red herrings would be great for Christmas, wouldn't they?
Wouldn't they?
So this is for the solstice dinner. I like to have some fish. We don't have a lot of fish in Iowa, so I do a pickled herring dish. And I make my own sour cream out of thick cream, and I just put a culture in and let it sit for a couple of days. So this recipe is... I have a big cheat. I just go to the regular grocery store and buy the pickled herring, and then I drain off all the stuff they put in it and add my own stuff. So you take the herring that's been drained, and I cut up some apples and some onions and a few carrots for color. And then I put the sour cream on and then horseradish. Mm-hmm. And it is so, so, so yummy. So we will be eating that on the solstice eve by candlelight. And let's see, some other Christmas things. Oh, we're also going to have, I'm going to make, gee, it doesn't really have a name, but it's chocolate and olive and garlic. So it's a
chocolate,
bruschetta.
Chocolate.
Right.
Chocolate.
Right.
Well, already I'm interested.
Right, but it's not sweet.
Here we go.
It's a savory chocolate thing. So this is a bruschetta. So you're basically toasting a piece of white crusty bread. And you have melted some dark chocolate chips. And into that you mix a black olive tapenade or puree. So it's, you know, the two are the same color, so you don't see them. So it's like salty and chocolatey and not terribly sweet. And then I've got this over a double boiler. And then to that, I chop some very finely chopped fresh garlic. And then I warm it just enough that the garlic slightly cooks into the chocolate and the olive. And then you spread that onto the toast. And then you put some roasted or grilled red peppers on the top of it.
Oh.
Yummy, yummy, yummy.
That sounds like a fuss, but boy, does that sound fun.
You know what?
Fun.
It's not. It's really easy to make.
Oh,
you just
it sounds fun.
Put it in the, you know, the, well, my idea of a double boiler is just a pan with water in it and a metal bowl over the top. So it's actually quite easy to make for a rather impressive looking and unusual little hors d'oeuvre.
Oh, appetizers.
Appetizers,
oh, yes.
Appetizers. And another thing I'm going to make for the holidays is I'm going to make an eggnog panna cotta. And I'm probably also going to make eggnog. Eggnog is really simple. Just in the blender I put, because we have really good eggs here, I put fresh raw eggs, milk, cream, sugar, whip it up, and then you pour a little brandy or a little rum into it.
What is a little?
It's up to your discretion.
Oh, because a shot.
I think for a party, I'd probably put a shot per cup.
Oh, okay.
Maybe.
Yeah, yeah. All right. That sounds good.
You know, you can be a little more modest than that, yeah, if you want. Or for the panna cotta, I'm going to make the eggnog, and I will put less alcohol in it, just enough to flavor it. And then you mix it with a little bit of gelatin, and then let it, you know, firm up in the refrigerator. So it's like a little custardy thing.
Oh, good.
And I'm going to serve it with your ginger snaps. Tell us about your ginger snaps.
Ginger snaps. For years I have been making ginger snaps, and I take them to potlucks, and people seem to like them.
Yeah, it's like, I bet you can't eat just one. They're good.
And they're pretty good, and they are really, I love to have ginger snaps around Christmas time. They just taste right. They just taste right. I'll let you know that this recipe is on the Donna Lana Kitchen webpage, which is part of the KHOI website, and you can find that at khoifm.org. Go to Talk, go to Donna Lana Kitchen, and find the recipes there and past shows. But anyway, look for the ginger snap cookie recipe. I originally got this recipe long, long time ago from the Des Moines Register when they were putting really good recipes in, I don't know, long about the early 90s or the late 80s, something like that. They had good recipes in the Des Moines Register. And this is the Des Moines Register ginger snap cookies. I've changed it a little bit because originally the Des Moines Register recipe called for 1 cup Crisco to start out with. And I've sort of like moved on from that. And so in the recipe, I just put 1 cup shortening. You can use your own judgment there. I tend to use butter. And I've even used some good lard, too.
I think butter and lard together might make a nice combination.
It does. I find that all butter makes them really soft and yummy, but I kind of like ginger snaps to have some snap and be a little crackly, and it seems that a little bit of lard or something else in it would help a little bit with that, and it's got lots of molasses in it. And I make it with a good helping of ground ginger, and I've also chopped up a tablespoon of candied ginger. And that stuff is good just to have in the kitchen to nibble on, but I like that too. If you really want to be fancy, You could really wouldn't be fancy. You could also grate in some fresh ginger root,
yes.
And then you could have a three ginger snap, and it would be. But I didn't do that. I'm lucky to have two out of the three in my kitchen at one time. So I just go anyway. The recipe's on the website. We have a special guest with us today. Yes, it's that jolly old soul with
ho,
the
ho, ho.
With the long gray beard and the twinkle in his eye. It's Jim Peace. Jim Peace, yes, it is. Welcome to our studio, Jim.
Well, thank you. It's
James Peace, Emeritus Associate Professor, Natural Resource Ecology and Management, ISU. And he has been a part of this community for a long time. You have heard his voice on public radio enlightening us about all sorts of things wild and animal-like and what the heck to do with about the squirrels in our attic, all that sort of thing.
You bet.
Yeah.
I have to just say one thing. He really does look like Santa Claus. He's got a right eyebrow that raises up into an arch where you see those pictures of Santa giving that quizzical look.
Well, I asked Jim to join us today because he really is the go-to guy for the part of the world that we often ignore, all the creatures out there. And I'm going to ask him today about reindeer. So, Jim, what is this about reindeer? There's the American version. There's the European version. Jim, what about reindeer?
Well, reindeer are really the European version of what we call caribou in North America. Ranger fur tarandus is a genus and species.
Ranger fur tarandus.
Ranger
oh,
fur
boy,
tarandus,
oh
right. And that's the genus and species. And like a lot of species, it's really a circumpolar species. It's one that surrounds not just in North America, but across Europe and Asia as well. And there
the
are
North
other
Pole.
Things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They're around the North Pole. And when that was connected by ice, especially with the last ice age, 12, 14, 15,000 years ago, round in there, those species became, sort of, they were one species, and they still are one species. But as the ice receded,
they got a little isolated genetic pockets.
Exactly.
Uh-huh,
they got a little more isolated. And so you have some
diversity.
Yeah, diversity going on.
Oh,
exactly.
Boy, oh boy.
And adapting
and
to particular
conditions.
And some have
red noses and some have,
Right. That's right. That's maybe with a red nose. I think those are Russian. No, I'm not
okay.
sure. So it has something to do with vodka. I don't know.
Okay.
But so there are other species that are circumpolar that you might not think about too much. One is the snowy owls. Snowy owls are circumpolar. They're the same species around the pole. Weasels, the little ermine.
The white
one in the winter. Yep, those are circumpolar. Snowshoe hares and Arctic hares are both
all the fairy
circumpolar.
Tale animals.
Exactly.
Oh,
yeah,
boy.
Yeah. And in fact, the reason they're fairy tale animals is that the winters are long in the north.
And
you've got lots
stories.
Of time to do. That's right. Oh. Lots of times to come up with stories about the critters outside your window. And that's probably, in fact, where some of the other myths and stories came from regarding reindeer, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, so I have a reindeer question.
Yeah.
Are they, in my mind anyway, are they bigger than the deer that we have? Are they just a big, shaggy deer? How much bigger are they? What do they look like?
It depends on the subspecies because they range in size. So what we know in North America, across Canada, there's a boreal forest species mm-hmm. of caribou that we call woodland caribou. Used to be, the range used to be half of Canada, 50% of Canada. Was its range. Now it's much, much reduced and is not doing really very well. But they inhabit forests, wet forests of the boreal forests that have lots of lichens in them and everything, because this is a species worldwide that is a very heavy eater of lichens.
Oh.
Lichens are those plants that come in lots of forms.
Is that fungal family or not?
No.
That's
right. It's actually two different plants, a fungus and an algae that you might say have taken a lichen to each other. Sorry. Yeah, I don't get openings like that very often.
No, that's really perfect.
So
they're getting an algae and a fungal.
And a fungus.
They must have great gut biota.
Right, they do. And you're not talking about the algae and the fungus. You're talking about the caribou,
the
reindeer.
The algae and the fungus. Like, we should be all eating algae and fungus
sorts. They do have the right biota in their stomachs, in their rumens, in fact, in order to digest those. Can be fairly tough things to digest.
A diet of tree bark for six months of the year. Hello.
Yeah, like lots of other of the deer family, the cervid family, all the caribou are ruminants. That means they have a rumen, a gut like cattle do.
Do they have just one stomach or?
No, they have four.
Oh, just like cows.
And one of those is a rumen, which is really the important chamber, because that's the one that's filled with the right bacteria that can break down those plants. Mm-hmm. And if they don't have the right bacteria, or they're eating the plants that don't match the bacteria, they'll starve to death with a full stomach.
Whoa.
It's a tough one. So, yeah, so you got to have the right gut biota there, you know, in order to digest these things. And that's true of our deer as well, that eat lots of woody stuff through the winter. If they don't have the wood digesting bacteria, and you feed them lots of hay, you can feed them very, very fine hay, and they can't digest it. So that happens occasionally.
Don't feed the deer.
Right. That's right. So we're dealing across the whole world, the northern hemisphere. We're dealing with about seven subspecies of caribou or reindeer. So in Eurasia, in Europe and Asia, they're called reindeer, and in the northern U.S. they're called caribou. Northern U.S. In the northern North America, they're called caribou. It's really the same species, but there are subspecies. We go back to the story when the ice separated them. Mm-hmm. They've had a few thousand years now, at least, to sort of develop some different genetics. So there are differences in size. There are differences in behavior. There are some genetic differences that are detected.
And these are based on that their environments have become slightly differentiated.
Right, right. Uh-huh. And there are sort of three ways that you can classify caribou. One is, are they barren ground versus more woodland? You know,
So what do the barren ground ones eat?
Well, they eat lichens, but they have to.
The lichens that grow on the rocks
exactly.
and stuff like that?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, they have to scratch down through. In fact, the name caribou probably comes from a Gwich'in or some other native people's language, which means pawer or scratcher to describe their behavior as they paw down through the snow to get to the lichens.
So all winter, that's all they eat? Through the snow and they eat these little lichen off the...
Eat it off the rocks and off the... some lichens, there are lots of different species of lichens, and some lichens stick up they're really tall, maybe 3 or 4 inches tall. You know? So they eat some of those.
Do they get pretty skinny in the winter?
Well, they certainly lose weight if they don't have enough food, and they have to fight off the cold as well. And this is one of the neat things about all the deer species, but especially caribou. They have special hairs. Their hairs are actually hollow. And so,
like possum hairs.
Exactly. even more so. And they're like little tubes of air. And it's the dead air space then that provides the wonderful insulation. The porcupine herd you've probably seen on Nature and other channels on TV, these incredible migrations. And they're one of the longest mammal migrations in the world. They make a huge sort of triangular circuit. They end up on the calving grounds in the area that we now know as the as a wildlife refuge. So they end up on the plains at just the right time for calving, because those plains
would be the spring, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, spring up there. It mm-hmm. would be summer down here, but spring up there, and because that's when the richest availability of sedges and other grasses and grass-like plants that come up, and that's what the young need, the mothers need, in order to provide the richest milk for their young.
So
but then the mosquitoes come out.
No, but they have fur. So do they, this big migration that they make, they obviously don't respect the border between Alaska and Canada, right?
Not
they
at all.
They just do a whole North American
loop. Exactly.
Oh, wow.
Politics don't bother them at all. So
the wisdom of the caribou.
That's right. Absolutely. So then the mosquitoes come out and they begin to move. They keep moving because the mosquitoes get to be too much.
What do they bite their noses or something?
Noses and eyes and every ears, any exposed skin at all. It's a tough one. So they make this huge route. Woodland caribou do not. The reindeer in Eurasia tend not to be, while they do form, and again, there are seven subspecies of this critter, the ranger fur, the reindeer.
And we tend to forget that Europe and Asia are actually one landmass.
Exactly.
So that gives them another borderless area.
Right. Uh-huh. And also the peoples of Europe and Asia reacted differently to the large herds of caribou than the peoples of northern North America.
They didn't all just eat them?
Well, they all ate them.
Okay.
But the ones in Europe, we think at least 2,000 years ago, the peoples of Eurasia, of Europe and Asia, actually domesticated some of those.
Oh.
So that's where we get
the Laplanders?
The Laplanders and other peoples. Actually, there are different different peoples that have domesticated the herds, and they've domesticated them to different degrees, but they all depended on them for food, for shelter, for an awful lot of other things in their
shelter
culture.
Shelter in terms of, like, skins, right?
Skins, exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Really, really important. So,
okay, so those igloos were not really built out of ice, right?
The igloos in North America certainly were built out of snow and ice, but not in Eurasia. The skins provided a lot of the still provide a lot of the shelter for them, as well as clothing in many cases. So they reacted differently. And in fact, it's been interesting. They domesticated reindeer were tried to be introduced into Alaska and some of the northern provinces.
You mean they actually took the genetic species from Eurasia and brought them over?
Right. Right.
Isn't that because like squirrels? Wasn't there a turf war over that?
Yeah. and in fact, it turned out it wasn't so much a turf war between the animals as between the humans, because they really found they didn't like it to domesticate them very much. They really wanted their traditional way of hunting them during the migration. So they've done
that. Well, they'd honed that for several thousand years.
Absolutely.
Why mess with it?
Why change? Exactly. So, but somebody thought they had a good idea, and it just hasn't worked out very well.
We were making some cultural impositions,
right,
I suppose.
Right, yeah. So, well, one of the things that is the other way that they so there are three ways of classifying them, whether they herd or whether they're solitary, whether they are barren ground versus a more woodland environment. So it's the sort of the ecotype they are. And then whether they are migrating or tend to stay in one place.
Oh, some don't migrate.
That's right. Woodland caribou don't migrate.
Oh, because their food source is so constant.
Exactly. Well, it's more constant than – yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So you migrate – you undertake these long migrations
primarily for food. Yeah, why would you move except
to get for your food? Yeah, exactly. Right. Exactly. So so it's – you know, those are some of the ways. But one of the things they all have in common – is that they all have these massive antlers, you know.
Oh, the picturesque stuff. Oh, there
absolutely.
You go.
Male and female.
Male and female. Exactly. Exactly. Very good. Very good. Because it's one of the few deer species that both males and females have antlers, although the male antlers tend to be a little bit larger because they're more for defense. But the females have them as well. It's also a good defense for them against predators like wolves.
Right. I'm trying to think what would be the adaptive advantage.
Right.
Oh.
And
okay.
That and the fact that they have this sort of scoop shovel on the front that sticks out
straight. Oh, for digging in this.
Exactly.
No. Oh.
Exactly.
How
and
clever.
They sweep their heads back and forth, and that scoop shovel piece of antlers in front moves the snow
out of the way.
Oh, I'd
rather have one of those than a snowblower any day.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, it's kind of hard to get through doorways, though. Yeah, we'd have to make doors a lot taller.
We can accommodate. I mean, just for the thrill of it.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
We can adapt.
Absolutely.
Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. You're listening to KHOI Radio. That music was by the Iowa band Harvest Home, Al and Alita Murphy and Bob Black from their Christmas album. I believe it's called It's Christmas Time or something like that. They do a fine job. They're over in Eastern Iowa. And that tune, that was two tunes you just heard. The first one was the Silver Bells reel and then kind of morphed into Jingle Bells there. Al Murphy in his liner notes on the little CD says that the tune Silver Bells, it's not the Silver Bells we know. It's Silver Bells. He learned from the playing of Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys. It was popular in the early 20th century from the Tin Pan Alley Music Hall tradition, that version of Silver Bells. So people used to hum that a lot. We can hum it now. That's
silver
good.
Silver Bells.
And then there's that one. Then there's that one.
Silver Bells.
Thank you, Donna. That's good. So celebrate an old tradition. Start a new one. Start a new tradition. There's a tradition called breaking up Christmas, which is what a bunch of dancers do when they don't know what to do between Christmas and New Year's, and they break it up with dance parties. This tune is called Breaking Up Christmas by the Harvest Home Band. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen with Donna Prescintis and Lana Nachtigal with special guest Mary Swander. Listen to the Donna Lana Kitchen, Tuesdays at noon. We do this live, folks, with no net. Repeat it at 7 o'clock in the evening.
Slide into the holidays with style and grace. Eat good food and enjoy life.
Santa Claus come done and gone, breaking up Christmas right along. Yonder a long time ago, the old folks passed the do-si-do.